The Future of Social Media and Student Affairs. Up to this point, we've been discussing the present, social media sites and services students are currently using. We often think that technological innovation is tied to societal progress. However, we also tend to think that most emerging technologies will be short-lived. One thing is certain, technological progress moves ahead at a lightning speed, while societal and psychological adaptation to these technologies lags behind. We've seen this with other technologies that create great societal tensions about their use, like the typewriter, telephone, and television. Moore's law is the proposition that the number of transistors on integrated circuits will double about every 18 months. Moore described this trend, and it has proved surprisingly accurate over the years. You might be wondering how Moore's law about transistors applies to social media. We can extrapolate from Moore's law to forecast the proliferation of new social technologies and new methods for interacting with them. Social technologies will likely continue to evolve and develop in ways that we might not be able to imagine, with a resultant lag in societal understanding and adaptation. Years before Facebook was invented, and when Mark Zuckerberg was still in high school, Wellman described how the internet was helping people extend their offline social networks. He wrote, quote, "It is becoming clear that the internet is not destroying community, but is resonating with and extending the types of networked community that have already become prevalent in the developed Western world." End quote. Although I focused on the applications we now call social media, it is clear that the internet was used for social connections well before we had these containers for our social interactions, such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. We've been social online long before the advent of our current set of social media, and will be social long after Facebook and Twitter have been forgotten. But what comes next? Perhaps not exactly paraphrasing Oscar Wilde, quote, "Social media imitate life, and life imitates social media," end quote. In other words, new technologies are developed all the time that help people be more social, more productive, and so on. However, only a few catch on to reach the popularity of Facebook and Twitter. Perhaps the primary reason some social media are adopted and some fall to the wayside is that certain sites and services fill a social or societal need at the time they are developed. Sometimes, as is the case with the sites popular today, it was unclear there was a need until after the sites were developed and adopted. Clearly, college students wanted a technologically mediated way to learn about and interact with their on-campus peers, and Facebook gave them that. Widespread adoption after Facebook was opened up to all users showed a societal need for increased connection. Indeed, as Western society has become more affluent, individuals move around more and have less opportunity to establish strong offline bonds. Social media sites and services, like Facebook, allow people to maintain and strengthen already existing connections, even after moving away geographically. Carl Sagan's seemingly bleak reflections on our technological adolescence are pertinent when thinking about the social tensions inherent in technological growth. Because of our technological progress, Sagan thought we might destroy ourselves before reaching greater states of human, technological, and industrial development. We may be so captivated by technological progress that we would develop an alluring technology that, when used, would destroy life. In the movie version of his book, Contact, Sagan expanded this idea to address the tension between technological progress and social isolation. The main character, Ellie, is selected as the only human to travel in a machine and to meet an alien. When she meets the alien, who has taken the form of her deceased father, he reflects on the human condition, quote, "You feel so lost, so cut off, so alone. Only you're not. See, in all our searching, the only thing we've found that makes the emptiness bearable is each other," end quote. Humans have a need to connect, and the progress of industrialization has forced onto us increased social distance. However, with social technologies, we are able to take a piece of that very industry that made us disconnected and use it to connect and make the emptiness bearable. Think about this need for connection in the context of a new student moving away from home and onto campus for the first time. He or she has a strong need to affiliate, to connect with peers, to feel validated, and ultimately, to feel loved. Social media help us seek these connections in new ways. While social media allow us to connect in ways we were unable to in the past, social tensions do arise as society progresses along the social media adoption curve. Other chapters have covered the adult normative perspective, the viewpoint that interprets youth behavior in terms of adult norms. Traditional media outlets really benefit by promoting the negatives of youth social media use, and these messages are adopted by adults and often by youth themselves. Additionally, these messages are integrated into K-12 education. While policies are starting to change, almost all K-12 school districts ban the use of social media. Traditional media outlets typically select stories about social media because they are provocative and garner viewership or readership. Unfortunately, almost exclusively, the most popularized stories are about negative impacts of social media use. Further, Reporters are not scientists, so 1. They don't seek evidence that contradicts their theories, and 2. They rarely judge the scientific methods of a story, especially one focused on research about social media. Clearly, some negative outcomes are associated with social media use, but the positive outcomes must be considered as well. Social tension arises because we as a society write off social media, or, worse, see social media as eroding the fabric of our society and ruining our youth. Part of this tension, no doubt, stems from a lack of understanding from those who didn't grow up with social media. It's a lot easier to stick with a preconceived notion than to try to collect evidence to negate that notion. If we rigidly believe that social media are bad, then we are also saying that youth are engaging in a harmful behavior daily, even though these technologies are integrated fully into the fabric of their normal social lives and psychological development. Student affairs professionals do not get to have the luxury of following along with the status quo. They must engage in personal and professional soul-searching to best help support and challenge students. To be clear, there are situations and reasons requiring us to be mindful of the dangers of social media use and to communicate that information to students. However, these communications will be much better received and more effective when we engage with students from their perspective, not ours. As suggested in earlier chapters, there's no better way to lose a student than to take a prescriptive approach. The goal is not for students to think, quote, "This person knows nothing about what I do online, and yet they are telling me what I do is wrong," end quote. But instead to think, quote, "This person understands what I do online and is helping me see some of the ways that I can use social media to my benefit," end quote. New technologies are developed and adopted at such a rapid rate that they allow us little time to catch up psychologically and socially. Mobile phones have changed the way we communicate in obvious and not so obvious ways. Commenting on her own observations as well as data from Nielsen about mobile phone use, Paul exclaimed, "Nobody calls me anymore." Paul was commenting on the social phenomenon of preferring text messaging to voice calls and pointed out that some people become annoyed when they receive an unplanned phone call. Another psychological and societal tension involving mobile phones is texting and driving. Texting while driving is hazardous and doubles the chances of a crash or near crash. Nevertheless, drivers still text. Part of the reason is that our judgments about the safety of texting and driving are just developing. This issue was not a concern before the advent of mobile phones that made texting easier through the use of a keyboard, cell phone plans that allowed unlimited texting, and a societal shift away from making phone calls to texting. In this sense, and as Sagan warned, individually and as a society, we have to catch up with technology before our behaviors associated with that technology quite literally kill us. In other words, we have to survive our technological adolescence. More people are becoming aware of the dangers of text messaging, and as of this writing, 41 states have passed laws making it illegal to text while driving, though legislation is not necessarily the best way to handle this issue. At least these states recognize the problem. Student affairs professionals must work to understand how students are using emerging technologies, both discovering what is normative and beneficial, and also learning about how these technologies can and do harm students. The goal is to help students minimize the negative impacts of technology while promoting the positive. Understanding the social and psychological tensions inherent in the adoption of technology in general will help you predict how students will react to new technologies with similar affordances. For instance, it is no surprise that youth use Snapchat to send silly, embarrassing, or provocative pictures, given that Snapchat has affordances similar to those of Instagram and texting, the ability to send a picture directly to a friend's phone, as well as 4chan, the temporary and ephemeral nature of the pictures. Another social tension that Snapchat may fuel in the future is an increase or a shift to communicating via images instead of text messages, given the rapid growth in technologies that enable such sharing. The founder of Snapchat, Evan Spiegel, said, quote, "The minute you tell someone that images on your server disappear, everyone jumps to sexting," end quote. Even though he's trying to minimize this issue, it does seem that Snapchat affords users more comfort with sexting. Snapchat, then, is a good example of the tensions between how youth use and understand a technology and how adults interpret their behaviors. American society has interesting double standards about sexuality. We have a puritanical taboo against talking about sexuality very directly, even though we support rather explicit portrayals of sexuality in movies, television, and advertising. We sexualize and exploit children in advertising, turning girls into part objects that bear little resemblance to what women actually look like. Yet we have a great problem thinking and talking about emerging adult sexuality. As a result, sexting is automatically seen as something negative. What if adolescents are sexting? What if, and I posit that this is actually the case, sexting is a healthy and normative outlet of young adult sexuality? Sexting doesn't indicate a significant change in teen sexual behavior or risk-taking. Instead, sexting just makes teen sexual behaviors more visible to adults. Research has shown a correlation between sexting and being sexually active. However, There is no relationship between sexting and riskier sexual behaviors, like unprotected sex. Additionally, longitudinal data show that the proportion of U.S. adolescents who are sexually active has declined in recent years. Other research has also suggested that sexting is a normal facet of young adult sexual activity, used by older teens as yet another way to explore and develop their identities. Sexting is especially important for young adults who are exploring an LGBT identity. Of course, the danger inherent in sending nude pictures of oneself is that those pictures will be sent to other parties, or even posted on the internet for the public to see. Having pictures shared publicly becomes yet another tension in the relationship among society, technology, and different modes and cultures of use because of societal norms about nudity and sexuality, as well as what my colleague Eric Gordon and I call the asshole problem. The asshole problem. Sexting is a normative part of emerging adult and even emerged adult sexual expression. However, some unscrupulous actors, who are appropriately termed assholes, will release these images publicly and break the trust of the sender. Such behaviors are perhaps related to the asshole's inability to process discontent about the subject of the picture in a healthy way. The person whose image is shared is at an added risk because U.S. society has a problem, not only with young adult sexuality specifically, but with nudity in general. Indeed, we have criminalized nudity in public spaces like beaches, an idea anathema to a majority of European Union citizens. So when an image is released that has been shared in confidence, it is not evaluated as a mistake of youth, but instead is seen as that person's sexual deviancy. Ideally, it would be understood in our culture that young adults, teens, and college students can actually engage in normal and normative expressions of sexuality. The tension that arises when sexting images are released publicly is between youth who use sexting as a natural form of self-expression and sexual identity exploration, and individuals who have not spent their formative years using technology in the same ways. As examined in Chapter 1, this dilemma speaks to the issue of digital inequalities expressed when those with privilege, like an admissions officer or a potential boss, pass judgment on a younger person because of cultural differences in behavior. Luckily, this doesn't happen often, with one study finding that only 2% of sexters had their photo shared with someone they didn't want to see it. While it is unlikely that a future employer or admissions officer could see a photo shared in confidence, it is more likely that peers will share and shame the sexter for the image. But it's not the peer's fault. Adolescents who would shame someone for having taken a nude photograph are just reacting in the same way that we do as a society, engaging in double standards about sexuality. Sexting has parallels in other cultural taboos. For example, in American culture, we rarely discuss the fact that as adults, we are sexually active, yet many adults have children. This discussion is necessarily provocative when viewed through the adult normative lens, which serves to emphasize the point that just because youth are engaging in a behavior doesn't mean it is incorrect or wrong. And just because an individual thinks something is right doesn't mean it's right for everybody. In fact, research by the Pew Internet and American Life Project shows that adults aged 25 to 34 are more likely to sext than any other age group. Perhaps as we mature as a society, some of these tensions will dissipate, though they may well be replaced by new tensions between emerging technologies and social forces. These are some dynamics to be aware of as future technologies develop that allow for sharing of more intimate details of our lives. Indeed, in late 2013, Google released its Glass product, which is a device that is worn like eyeglasses and which offers much of the functionality of a mobile phone, including the capability to take pictures and videos. One can see the opportunity for youth to use Glass to document even more private details of their lives and easily share them publicly. Expect that the future will bring new social media technologies that will help us move closer together and battle the social distance inherent in our fast-paced and mobile worlds. What exactly these technologies will look like is beyond the prognosticating abilities of this author. However, I have great hope that these technologies will be positive outlets for students and others to explore their identities, share, connect, and create and build communities and networks to support their psychosocial and physical development. Furthermore, and of importance to student affairs professionals, how students use these technologies will predict their benefits and risks. Using new technologies for connection and communication will likely continue to predict positive outcomes, while using new technologies for disconnection and isolation will lead to negative outcomes. The processes are important to understand as student affairs professionals keep up with new technological trends, and the most straightforward way to do this is to talk to the students themselves. Don't believe the hype when you hear about a new technology ruining our youth, because perhaps that new technology is helping youth connect and engage in ways never before possible. Take it upon yourself, as an educator who specializes in the culture of students, to explore with them how they are using the technology, what it means to them, and its affordances. Learn about the technology yourself. What are the benefits and pitfalls? Sign up for an account, if there is such a thing as an account, and explore the technology yourself. Oliver Sacks titled one of his books An Anthropologist on Mars, a phrase used by Temple Grandin, who was diagnosed with autism, to describe her inability to understand the nuances of human emotion. To compensate, she would attempt to discern cognitively how people would behave in certain situations. In other words, she was an observer of human interactions and emotions, cognitively learning from them as much as she could to balance out her inability to understand them emotionally. Student affairs professionals are urged to be anthropologists on Mars when it comes to current and future technology use. Be curious and view students' digital worlds through their eyes. Then, tie their experiences to your knowledge of student development to help students in their growth. Make sure, however, that by doing so you are not driving a wedge between yourself and your students. One of my biggest professional regrets is that some readers interpreted the information in our Connecting to the Net Generation book to mean that our students are so different from us that we could never truly understand them. This interpretation is perhaps exactly opposite to the book's intention and a most unfitting viewpoint for someone working in the field of student affairs. As educators, we must strive to build interpersonal connections with our students that will help engage them, add to their social and academic integration, and challenge and support them through their college years, and perhaps beyond. Thinking that our students are very different from us because they do things differently is the same as stereotyping, say, all Latino or all lesbian students. So, as you move forward and consider new technologies that emerge, and more important, how students use those technologies, it helps to take a curious stance, much like an anthropologist than a student affairs professional. The more you can learn about student normative behavior, the better you will be at connecting with students and making a positive difference in their lives. In terms of personal adoption of new technologies, if you are a social media crusader, try your best to be a social media skeptic, and vice versa. As you have no doubt gathered from reading this book, the gray area of social media enthusiasm, where you understand that there are benefits and pitfalls, and that these depend on how the technologies are used, is a good place from which to examine and figure out what is best for our students. Removing ourselves from the poles of the crusader-skeptic dichotomy allows us to be more critical about the methods we are using to engage students in educationally relevant interventions. By reducing our ego investment in a particular outcome based on our pre-existing viewpoint, we become more open to evaluating the effectiveness of our interventions. Put another way, being open to being wrong about the benefits and the pitfalls of social media allows us to have a clearer view of what is actually happening in the lives of our students. This outlook will propel us to address new technologies with vigor and to be on the leading edge of supporting students. Learning and trace analytics. While a number of currently emerging technologies might be of potential benefit to student development and learning, none seems more promising and more suitable to an evidence-based approach than learning analytics. Learning analytics is the use of student-produced data to predict outcomes and tailor education, and is often thought of as a practical application of big data in education. An example of the use of big data outside of education is the way a website like Amazon.com knows the kinds of things that you like based on your shopping and web browsing habits. Another example is the way Google tracks your browsing habits in order to provide ads uniquely tailored to you on the web pages you visit. Google crunches the data using secret sauce algorithms to predict what you want to buy and what you will buy based on not just your own behavior, but also on the behavior of other like-minded users. Although these examples may be seen as underhanded marketing practices, the same methods can be used to benefit students in educational settings. Up to this point, student affairs professionals have had to rely on limited sources of data to predict student success and to identify students with whom they might need to intervene. For instance, how can we tell whether a student is struggling academically? Typically, we have relied on students' overall semester or, when available, midterm grade point averages. Sometimes, when we work closely with students, they might share their course exam and paper grades with us. These data, however, are of limited use in helping students succeed. For if a student comes to us for help once they've already failed a few exams, or, worse, an entire semester, it is much more difficult to help the student get back on track. Advisors often suggest that first semester students drop a course instead of receiving a poor grade because of the potential blow to their overall GPA, which affects continued enrollment in a major or at the institution. Surveys, learning outcomes assessments, and student demographic information have been other sources traditionally used to try to identify students in need of help, again, with limited predictive ability. Imagine that you could have data, collected unobtrusively, showing which students might need additional support in real time. Learning analytics can be used to provide important data about student success without having to rely on traditional, weak measures. The process of learning analytics is focused on collecting large amounts of data in order to identify patterns that will help tailor education more precisely for each student. This process has its roots in the big data revolution, the use of massive amounts of data, along with great computing power, to find patterns and make predictions. These processes have been applied to making predictions about personal traits, behaviors, and shopping habits. In a study exemplifying the predictive ability of simple data, Kosinski, Stilwell, and Grapel found that Facebook likes predicted, with a high degree of accuracy, traits such as age, gender, sexual orientation, race, religious preference, and political affiliation. Facebook likes also predicted, with a good degree of accuracy, relationship status, substance use, whether a user's parents stayed together or separated before the user reached the age of 21, and the personality traits of openness, extroversion, and intelligence. To put it simply, online behavior that doesn't seem to be related to complex information, such as a person's sexual orientation or the fact he or she is an extrovert, actually yields a great deal of predictive power for such outcomes. The following five steps of analysis characterize the learning analytics process. 1. Capture. Data are collected or captured through various methods, such as a course or learning management system, enrollment databases, or the student information system. 2. Report. Once data have been captured, aggregated, and stored in a location such as a database, those with access can run basic descriptive reports. 3. Predict. Ultimately, the goal of learning analytics is to build predictive models using statistical techniques like linear and logistic regression. 4. Act. Predictive models help administrators and student affairs professionals take actionable steps, whether to provide students with information or to develop and implement an intervention. 5. Refine. The final step is to use information from the process to improve further iterations of the system. In practice and up to this point, the majority of learning analytics projects collect data from learning and course management systems. Purdue University's Signals Analytic Project exemplifies how colleges and universities are using learning analytics today. The Signals Project mines data from the Student Information System, SIS, Course Management System, CMS, and Gradebook to flag at-risk students by posting a traffic signal indicator on the CMS homepage. Signals uses the following four components to predict a student's risk status: percentage or points earned in the course, the student's interactions on the Blackboard CMS compared with their peers, their academic background, high school GPA, SAT scores, and student characteristics. Based on the results of this predictive model, the traffic signal indicator may be changed, an email message or text message sent, or a referral made to an academic advisor or for a face-to-face meeting with a course instructor. Typically, activity data collected through learning analytics tools include information about engagement with the learning community, uploading content, quiz scores, and number of logins. However, engagement is typically narrowly defined as posts on discussion forums, chat sessions, and CMS message access. Research shows a relationship between CMS activity and course outcomes. In a study at a single university, McFadden and Dawson found that the number of discussion messages posted, the number of discussion messages read, and the number of discussion replies posted were all significantly related to final course grades. A similar study by Smith, Lang, and Houston found that login frequency, site engagement, weighted login frequency, weighted site engagement, and points submitted were all correlated with successful course outcome, that is, whether students earned a final higher grade of C or higher. The problem with these analyses is that course grade is partly dependent on CMS activity, and therefore correlations between CMS activity and course grades reflect students' completion of actual assignments. Put another way, correlating CMS activity with final course grade is similar to correlating required assignments to final course grade. There will always be a strong relationship between the two, for if students don't complete the assignments, they don't pass the course. Although this distinction seems simple, it serves to illustrate that the results of current implementations of predictive analytics are weaker than reported. If these projects were to parse out the variance associated with required online activity, their predictive power would likely suffer. Furthermore, while some learning analytics systems like Purdue Signals include data from sources extraneous to the CMS, most do not. Unfortunately, typical projects fall short of the promise of learning analytics because they use limited types and amounts of data, such as number of posts and discussion views. In addition, the predictive statistics uncovered are often exaggerated because of an existing relationship between assignment completion and course outcomes. What is needed in the field of learning analytics is an expansion of the systems to collect and use data that bolster predictive models and that allow for more fine-tuned interventions. With any predictive model, increasing the number and quality of the predictors should, to a point, produce more accurate results. As we have seen from research outside of education, such as that of Kosinski and colleagues, seemingly meaningless data can be used to make strong predictions about people and their behaviors. Trace analytics is the term I have coined to refer to using seemingly irrelevant user-generated data to predict learning outcomes. These data are usually disregarded or not even thought about by the end user. Some examples of data that can be used for trace analytics include time spent on various computer activities, geolocation data, check-ins, proportion of social and recreational uses of technology versus academic uses, and incidental activities on websites, such as Facebook likes or Twitter retweets. You might wonder how these activities could possibly predict academic outcomes. The concept behind such spooky analytics is almost purely psychometric and requires a discussion of the difference between observed and true scores. In psychometrics, classical test theory presumes that each person has a true score on any given construct, such as intelligence, which is the score that would be obtained if there were no errors in measurement of that construct. However, we can never correctly know a person's true score and must approximate it by understanding that the true score is a combination of the observed score on a test along with error. We can extend this idea to constructs. A major problem of correlational research is the third, fourth, fifth, etc. variable problem. That is, that a presumed causal relationship between two variables might actually be caused by an unmeasured third, fourth, or fifth variable, or some combination of variables. As explained in Chapter 1, the negative correlation discovered between Facebook use and grades may be caused by a student's self-regulation, or lack thereof. In such a case, self-regulation would mediate the relationship between Facebook use and grades, as well as be related to both. A student who has less motivation to engage in academic pursuits may be one who uses Facebook more and may have lower grades, not because the student uses Facebook more, but because the student is not motivated to engage in academic-related activities. In such a case, the relationship between Facebook and grades is spurious. While my study, and the one by Kirshner and Karpinski, did not measure self-regulation, student Facebook use might have been a proxy for this construct. Of course, Facebook use does not fully equate to self-regulation. However, in this example, Facebook use might share enough variance with student self-regulation that it serves well as a proxy. Extrapolating this example out further and in combination with research showing that seemingly irrelevant data can predict significant outcomes, we can see how social media trace analytics might serve useful purposes in predicting student success. The Association for Middle Level Education, AMLE, defines formative assessment as part of the educational process. When, quote, incorporated into classroom practice, it provides the information needed to adjust teaching and learning while they are happening, end quote. Furthermore, quote, formative assessment helps teachers determine next steps during the learning process, as the instruction approaches the summative assessment of student learning, end quote. Adding trace analytics to existing learning analytics methods can enhance their ability to serve as formative assessments in order to identify student struggles and intervene as necessary. Therefore, one way to greatly increase the predictive ability of existing learning analytics systems would be to add to the predictive models the time students spent using search engines on Facebook and using word processing applications. Adding additional data would not only increase the model's predictive ability, but also help provide data at more regular intervals that can be used to check in on how students are doing. Put another way, faculty and administrators could know which students may be at risk before they complete their very first course assignment. Research has found a number of non-cognitive variables that are related to student success, such as time spent studying and appropriate use of study skills, study management and academic study results, SMART scores, cognitive strategy, self-concept, self-efficacy, test of reaction and adaptation to college, TRAC scores, and student motivation as measured by the Kaufman-Aggers Motivation Orientation Scale, KAMS, and personality characteristics, such as the Big Five personality factor, conscientiousness. Trace analytics can serve as a way to measure, via proxy, these non-cognitive variables critical to student success. Self-regulation has emerged as a non-cognitive variable that is strongly related to student success. Duckworth and Carlson defined self-regulation as, quote, the voluntary control of attentional, emotional, and behavioral impulses in the service of professionally valued goals and standards, end quote. Some researchers have suggested that self-regulation is almost identical to the Big Five personality factor of conscientiousness. The links between conscientiousness and academic outcomes are well established. While not currently possible, research is underway to identify trace data that can be easily collected and can serve as proxies for these non-cognitive variables. The goal is to provide faculty members and interested administrators the ability to conduct real-time monitoring and assessment of student progress well before the student submits any formal learning assessment in a course. Geolocation data might be an effective source of trace analytics. DeMontjoy, Hildegaux, Berlason, and Blondell studied a dataset of about 1.5 million mobile phone users. As with any mobile phone, each time a user initiates or receives a call or a text message, the location of the connecting antenna is recorded in the mobile operator's log. De Montjoy and colleagues used the geospatial trace data collected by such use and found that they could uniquely identify 95% of individuals using just 4 of these geospatial points. In other words, data gathered automatically and without the knowledge of mobile phone users can reveal private information about an individual. Anyone with access to such data can uniquely identify you and then re-identify you at any time without any additional information. While the De Montjoy and colleagues study has serious privacy implications, especially for those who use location-based social networks like Foursquare, the study's findings suggest that such information might be used to support student learning. Adding geolocation data to predictive analytics can help us build even stronger predictive models of student success. Perhaps it's the case that students who visit the library more do better on their chemistry exams, but not on their psychology exams, and that students who do better on their psychology exams happen to visit the psychology building more. Aggregating these geolocation data with other trace analytics, like digital textbook usage data, could serve to bolster the identification of students who are at risk of performing poorly in their psychology and chemistry courses even before they take an exam, alerting faculty, advisors, and student support professionals of potentially at-risk students as early as possible can help educators engage in conversations with these students to address their needs, which could have an impact on proximate course outcomes. Perhaps chemistry students may not need to be encouraged to visit the library more, although that's probably a good idea. Instead, it may be that library usage is tied to another critical student success variable, like self-regulation. So knowing that a student is using the library less might be an indicator that we have to help him or her with organizational skills, study strategies, or self-regulation. How might trace analytics be used in practice? In the past, we have identified at-risk students based on categories, lumping all students who are from low socioeconomic status backgrounds or all first-generation college students in one group. Categorical groupings based on background characteristics help focus our attention, yet they also include many more students than we need to focus on. Such groupings also exclude at-risk students who don't share these background characteristics. However, trace analytics allow us to move beyond these categorical groupings and identify specific students who are at risk based on their behaviors. This is a key distinction. Anyone who has worked in higher education long enough has met students in the at-risk category who are more motivated, focused, and successful than the general population of students. Trace analytics would allow student affairs professionals an efficient and unobtrusive method of quantifying student characteristics, such as engagement, a factor that has been difficult to measure until now. Imagine a residence hall director who has access to predictive results based on trace analytics. These results might show that one of the students in their hall will likely become disengaged within the next few weeks. Since we know that disengaged students are less likely to persist, the residence hall director might choose to intervene more directly with the student in order to improve the student's engagement and ultimately persistence. Trace analytics can effectively predict student learning outcomes. Some of my research has shown that even when controlling for prior academic achievement, user-generated digital textbook usage data can predict student course grades. Furthermore, digital textbook usage data are as strong a predictor of academic outcomes as prior academic achievement, and sometimes an even stronger predictor. This evidence means that we can use a real-time indicator of academic outcomes based on behaviors linked to positive educational outcomes. In other words, a student's reading behavior in any given week of the semester can help inform us about how well that student will do in the class, allowing us to intervene to help the student make fine-tuned adjustments in how he or she is working in a course. A student background characteristic like prior academic achievement will allow us to categorize students only once into the at-risk or not-at-risk category, whereas digital textbook usage data allows us to categorize students at any time during a course, which allows us to be more effective because the way the students engage with the course may change at any time during the semester. Of course, privacy issues need to be addressed when using trace data. Significantly, trace data have roots in commercial applications of big data. Therefore, only third parties have the expertise, infrastructure, and processing ability to collect and process these data. That fact means that novel applications of user-generated data in educational contexts will no doubt be handled by vendors not related to the colleges or universities that are using their services. It is crucial, then, that educational institutions delineate privacy ground rules with these companies to protect student data. The following are some privacy issues that educational institutions must address with technology vendors. How will data be collected and transmitted? User data should be decoupled from identifying information at its source. For instance, if textbook analytics data are being collected, then an ID number should be assigned to each student. Data should be encrypted when sent to the vendor handling the analytics. How will data be protected when handled by the vendor? What kind of shortage and encryption techniques will be used? Who will have access to the data and under what circumstances? Policies and procedures need to be in place so that the vendors comply with Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA, requirements. How will the vendor use the data beyond their analytics reporting? Will data be used for product improvement, research and development? What happens to student data when the contract with the vendor ends? While learning analytics is a relatively new field, the potential of trace analytics has not yet begun to be realized. As more interesting applications of these technologies emerge, privacy issues related to them must be addressed. In my work on the textbook analytics project, as well as in a larger trace analytics research study, students have reported being comfortable with the data collected and the purposes for which the data are used. Transparency is essential in communication with students about trace analytics data collection. Indeed, students become more comfortable with such new programs when they know how their information is being used, particularly when they know their data are being used to support their academic success. Since the field of educational trace analytics is in its infancy, it will be crucial to keep tabs on the privacy implications of collecting, analyzing, and reporting such data. What might the classroom of the future look like? Looking toward the future, readers of this book are likely to be most interested in technologies that help further engage students in active learning. Currently, there is a movement supporting the flipped classroom, where content is delivered outside class through various technologies, and the actual work, conducted through active learning, happens inside the classroom. Lectures are minimized or removed altogether from flipped classrooms, and they become more engaging academic spaces. Perhaps not all courses or subjects are appropriate for a fully flipped classroom, but the movement will no doubt have an impact on all educational processes. Extrapolating from this movement, we can imagine that the classroom of the future will be an engaging social space, where vigorous conversation and debate are encouraged, while technologies are employed to help students collaborate, communicate, and build a sense of classroom community. The near-term future should bring more social dynamics to the classroom. Chapter 5 outlined how research findings can be used to implement educationally relevant uses of social media in formal learning settings. With more research and more faculty implementing these technologies in relevant ways, there will be a shift in student expectations. Within the next 5 years or so, it is likely that an increased percentage of faculty will use social media like Facebook as a replacement for LMS-threaded discussions, and that more will use Twitter to extend classroom discussions and help students build community, as well as integrating these and other technologies in novel ways related to positive academic and social outcomes. Student affairs practitioners will likely also integrate social media even more in their practice in the near future. The fact that you are reading this book is perhaps a good indicator of the interest in the field for such work. There are already novel and relevant ways to use social media with students in the co-curriculum, see Chapter 4, and student affairs professionals will no doubt think of other very creative interventions. The near future will likely also bring more rigorous examination of social media interventions and dissemination of that information, so that others may learn from the outcomes. Student affairs professionals are in a unique position to use geolocation to engage students. The location-based gaming platform Scavenger was used by student affairs professionals to build digital scavenger hunts as part of student orientation activities, and to improve academic and social integration. Scavenger allowed student affairs professionals to build challenges that included checking in and completing tasks at campus locations. While Scavenger is no more, similar platforms are available, like Adventure Builder, or are under development. These kinds of platforms can be adapted to gamify engagement in academic and co-curricular activities. A number of popular new technologies so far have been purposely omitted from this chapter, as well as this book. Two of the most notable are massive open online courses, MOOCs, and badges. MOOCs are large-scale web-based courses open to anyone who wants to take them. MOOCs are popular in higher education, partly because a number of well-regarded institutions, like Harvard, MIT, and Berkeley, have been strong proponents. Badges are digital objects intended to be alternative forms of credentialing for skills and achievements. Badges can represent either in-class academic achievement or out-of-class skills. Early in their development, badges were conceptualized as serving as credentials for completing MOOCs and other online open courses. I haven't spent much time discussing MOOCs and badges because I'm not yet convinced of their viability as effective platforms. MOOCs are exactly the same as traditional online-only courses and can be thought of as digitization of a correspondence course. In other words, MOOCs are not engaging platforms, and I'm interested in technologies that allow us to increase student engagement, not the opposite. My concerns about badges are somewhat different. The concept behind badges is solid. However, it's not yet clear whether educational institutions will use them in ways that promote their adoption. In other words, the micro-credentialing movement is both interesting and potentially impactful for higher education. Yet, the badges container may not be the best choice. Time and research will tell whether badges can be a viable solution to document student skill sets for future employment and educational opportunities. Conclusion. Perhaps surprisingly to some, the internet was used for social interaction, connection, and social networking long before the current crop of social media sites and services appeared. This chapter has reviewed the societal forces and tensions that have led up to and resulted from the development of new technologies. Even though Sagan believed that we will either get through our technological adolescence or destroy ourselves, perhaps it's best to accept that human psychology and society will always lag behind technological progress. If we think of it as an evolutionary process, and to the chagrin of those who would tell you that, quote, the human brain is being rewired because of the use of technology, end quote, it may take hundreds of thousands of years before our biological and in turn psychological and social processes evolve to adapt fully to technological changes. By that time, there will likely be new technological standards to which to adapt. Viewed graphically, human adaptation to technological progress would most likely resemble an asymptote. Student affairs professionals, then, are encouraged to keep societal and psychological forces in mind when evaluating future technologies for their ability to be used in ways that help or harm our students. Psychological and societal forces make certain technologies more likely to be created and adopted. Societal forces are also what make student affairs professionals generally more inclined to see what students do online as inappropriate, deviant, or wrong. Examining the future of social technologies involves continually balancing our adult normative views with the experience of our students. As we do so, we'll align with these ideas and philosophies behind the flipped classroom movement, which places more trust, and therefore responsibility, on students for their own learning. And we will usher in progressive and expansive new paradigms in student affairs philosophies. As this book is being written, new research is being produced, and the social media platforms on which that research is based are changing. Technology is a reflection of who we are. As a society, we develop and support social media because they add value to our lives. It stands to reason that we'll continue building new technologies for interpersonal connection, and that some of these technologies will be widely adopted by society. In the current phase of social technological expansion, youth have been the driving force behind adoption. Perhaps that will change, or perhaps it's the willingness of youth to try new things and to be less rigid and set in their ways that drives adoption of emerging technologies. Either way, as new interaction and communication platforms are developed, youth will continue to use them throughout their psychosocial development to explore themselves and their interpersonal relationships. As new technologies are created that make communication more efficient, they will also make engaging with and supporting student learning more efficient. It is up to us as student affairs professionals to learn about these tools and to leverage them to support our students. The best way for you as a student affairs professional to keep up with social technology development and adoption is to talk with your students. Have them show you how they use social media and identify how these uses relate to the desired outcomes of a college education. As you learn, be skeptical but with an open mind. Examine social media as a biologist would examine a single-celled organism under a microscope, with a sense of inquisitiveness and desire to learn. Temper your excitement about new technologies, and don't let it get in the way of appropriate evaluations. It is important to learn about what works and what doesn't. Integrate assessment strategies when you put into practice social media programs and interventions. Then share your results with your PLN and the broader student affairs community. As evidenced by the book you have just finished reading, we know a lot about how using social media relates to student development and learning. However, we have much more to learn, especially about causal links between site usage and particular outcomes. A number of examples of how student affairs professionals are using social media were discussed in Chapter 4. Even though these seem to be effective uses of social technologies, how do we know what actually works? How do we know that social media themselves have an impact on student growth? We need to conduct research to answer these questions and parse out the variance among the social technologies, how they are used, and the engagement style of the student affairs professionals using them. You, as a student affairs professional, have great power to help our students change. With your help, a first-generation student can learn what it's like to be a college student. A disengaged student can be helped to be more engaged. A student who is homesick can be welcomed into the university environment, and a student who is on the path to self-discovery can be supported along the way. While these tasks can be accomplished by those not in student affairs, we occupy a unique place in colleges and universities and in the lives of our students. Not only can we do these things, we are best suited to do them because of our training and the collective values of our profession. Student affairs professionals can help others in higher education see the benefits of using social media to support students and balance out the negative messages being propagated through society. Student affairs professionals can lead the way in showing others how social media can be leveraged to meet students where they are and to bring them along to where we want them to be. Practical tips. Consider ways that you can support psychological and societal transitions inherent in the adoption of new technologies. 2. Explore the affordances and the impacts of emerging technologies along with your students. 3. Look for new ways of using available data to help support student developmental and learning outcomes. 4. Investigate ways that you can encourage students to use new technologies for informal learning. 5. Be skeptical of the promise of new technologies and collect data to evaluate their effectiveness whenever possible.